All right, so what all the talks today are about how cells signal, and bacterial cells are so exciting and so full of so much signaling packed in just this little package. And I've been thinking about this for about 35 years. Actually, I've been working on cell signaling, and hi, Carrie. It's about time you showed up. I didn't, you know. I'm going to try in the next hour and 10 minutes to try to get across to you all the things that I know about how bacteria work. And I'm not sure that I can do it, but let's just, since this is about signaling, let's get a couple things straight first. The first thing is, would somebody hit the AVMUTE, Carrie, do you think you can find that? Can you do that? Now I'm just gonna.
Do you want the screen back?
No.
Excuse me, could you repeat your name, please?
Let me think. Hoch, H-O-C-H. No problem. That's one thing I do know. Okay, if you don't remember anything after this talk today, which some people don't, but just remember that a gene regulation evolved last. So that is, there's a conserved core of genes that all bacteria have to have, virtually all of them, and that consists in bacillus of about 273 genes. Now, bacillus and E. coli and other bacteria that can grow in minimal type media have somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 genes. Yet they only really, if you give them amino acids and you give them bases and you give them the other small molecules they need, they only really need 273 genes about to grow. So the rest of the,
Could you knock out all the others and they would live?
Yes.
Wow. Oh, really? Oh,
one by one, you can. So.
That 273. I mean, the fact you quoted the three significant figures suggests it's accurate to more than one significant figure.
That's right. It is. Because it has been done already. Every gene's been knocked out individually in this organism.
So only that's a different question than the
only 273
are lethal.
No.
Yes, 273 are lethal when you knock them out.
I want to know if you knock out all the others and then there's 273, would it live?
Well, mycoplasma have about 500 genes. And
okay, but there was 500 genes.
Certainly. Certainly you can do that. So the only point I'm trying to make here is that the other genes have to be controlled because they respond to various small molecules or the need for small molecules like amino acids, et cetera, et cetera. That's right. He's worried about a protein coding genes, and that's what we're talking about. Was there any follow on to that, Tom? No.
So there were only 500 essential proteins for life.
Well, somewhere in that area. Somewhere in that area, okay? But really, if you knock them out one by one, you only find 273 are absolutely essential. All the rest of them are controlled by something, right? Now, the other.
Has anybody done any sort of course, the amount of experimentation is coming at really crazy, but how about knocking out pairs and things of that sort? Have there been experiments with like of the other?
Yeah, but the combinatorial
combinations
are fairly big.
Did you then start finding lethal pairs?
Probably. Probably you would. You know, If something can happen in biology, it will, right? Well, I want to get off of this subject because it clearly has, this is a controversial. So the point is that gene regulation evolved last, and that's one thing that you got to remember. So that as life evolved from some early bacterium into say archaea, the archaea group or the gram positive group or the gram negative group like E. coli or B. subtilis, and then on to eukaryotes, that the schemes that these bacteria use are different in many, many ways, such that something you learn from E. coli is not necessarily mean anything for a group over here. And indeed, some of the branches that come off of the gram-positive, different gram-positive use different schemes to control the same pathway. So there's no universal scheme. I mean, you can look at the biosynthesis of tryptophan, for example. It's a very simple pathway of five genes, five or six proteins. And the means by which E. coli controls that pathway is entirely different from the way B. subtilis controls that pathway, even though the pathway is identical, and the genes that are identical, and the proteins are identical, and the chemical pathway is the same. So what I'm going to tell you, what I'm going to talk about today is B. subtilis sporulation, because it allows you to look at the how cells integrate information through two-component signaling systems. And this, since E. coli doesn't make spores, this doesn't exist at all in E. coli. But this is the system I've been working on for some 30-some years. So let us first look at what we mean by two-component. Oh, wait a minute. I was going to tell you one more thing. So you've got this chromosome, and it's got about, let's say 3,500 genes that it has to control, right? And each one of those, there are several layers of control on each of these genes, one of which is, you may have gene here, which is controlled by a second gene here, a simple controlling gene controlling the output of that gene. On top of that, you've got several layers of control on top of that, including a sigma factors, which are specificity factors for the transcription machinery. Each of these genes that on the chromosome may have a particular sigma factor it needs to be transcribed. In B. subtilis, there are 18 of these. So there are 18 groups of genes controlled by different transcription factors, such that this gene may be controlled by sigma factor A, this gene down here controlled by sigma factor C or D or whatever, okay? Yes, there is. There's not overlap in specificity, but there's overlap in control. So some of these genes have both a sigma A and a sigma E gene. And they're used for different times in the life cycle of this bug. So there's a sigma factor story has been worked out primarily by Rich Losek at Harvard, and it's just a beautiful story. He's done just a wonderful job on it. So there are these levels of control. There are other levels that you've all heard of, heat shock and SOS. And in addition, there are a series, at least in Bacillus, there's a gene called ABRB, which is which I originally called a transition state regulator. I stole it from chemistry. But what these guys do are control many, many genes without base specificity, but they control it in different parts of the life cycle of the organism, such that ABRB is a gene, a protein of only 95 amino acids that controls about 100 genes. And it controls it in a non-base, there's no consensus base pair thing about how this thing controls. And it basically makes sure that stationary phase genes don't come on during log phase. So if you look at the organism's growth versus time, if this is log phase and this is stationary phase, this gene, this protein controls a whole set of genes that you don't want on during log phase, even if you've got the right signals to turn on those genes. Well, I have another PowerPoint presentation. It binds. Maybe we can talk about this after a while. But basically, it's complicated. It forms a dimer, and one helix binds in the major groove, and one binds in the minor groove. And there's something specific spatially about the promoters that it controls, right? Something. It's not really clear exactly what, but it does indeed bind only to specific promoters, and there's something spatially about those promoters that allows it to bind.
You mean like the structure of
the DNA? Yeah, that's the thought. I can show you the model, actually, of how it works, but I don't want to start that yet. I can do it. Believe me, have faith. Okay, now, are we okay with that, Sydney? All right, so what I'm going to talk today is about sporulation. And most of the studies, in fact, virtually all the studies I'm going to talk today have been done by my people that were in my lab, including Marta Perrigo. Oops, I guess I didn't put that down, did I? What a bozo. I should. And K.I. Varghese, who's a X-ray structure guy, and a guy from North Carolina State who's an NMR guy. And so, basically, first, we're going to talk about two-component systems, how two-component systems work, and we're going to use the structure of two-component systems that's been done in my lab to see how two-component systems interact, how they form the active site of phosphoryl transfer. And from that, we're going to try to make some implications about how signaling systems evolve specificity. And then the second part, we're going to go and look at how the phosphorelay how it integrates information from a lot of different places into an output. Okay. Now, first, let's start with two component systems. A lot of the genes that are controlled by environmental information are controlled through two-component signaling systems. These are found in bacteria, also in yeast, and in fungi, and in plants, not in humans, or in mice. Maybe not even in insects, I don't know. But two-component systems are strangely enough, they consist of two components. They're a little machines to look at information, to convert that information into, usually into transcription activation. All right? And the cell, something like E. coli or B. subtilis, contains somewhere between 30 and 40 pairs of these things. And each of the systems looks at different information, and each of the systems turns on different genes. Yet the structure of these things is virtually identical because they all evolve by gene duplication. So we'll get at that in a minute. Question is, how do they work? All right. So the first thing is the signal comes in, it activates a histidine kinase to hydrolyze ATP, and you get a phosphoryl group put on a histidine. That histidine, that four helix bundle containing histidine domain, binds specifically to this regulatory domain of this transcription factor. And the specificity of transfer then causes the active site to form, the phosphoryl group gets transferred, and you activate the transcription properties of this transcription factor. So the key to specificity here is there's specificity in the input signal, there's specificity in the interaction between these two domains, and of course there's specificity specificity for the genes to get activated. Now, this simply is a schematic of the number of histidine kinases that are present in bacillus, but there's the same sort of group are found in E. coli. And it shows that most of them are, most of the histidine kinases are embedded in the membrane, such that they, and it's thought that the signal input domain stuck in the membrane may be looking at information from outside, although I have to admit, there's several hundred or several thousand of these systems have been described in a lot of different bacteria, and the number of signals that we know, you can almost count on one hand. So these are the kinases, and so I guess mainly what the kinases we'll be talking about today are these, which are involved in making
the number of signals. You mean what's what is in the receptor?
I'm sorry.
When you said the number of signals, you can count on one hand.
Known signals.
The known signals.
Right.
So, which component is it that you can, there's only a few that are known?
The number of signals that are activating these kinases. We know the systems because you can define the genes, you can define the gene output, but finding
the molecule is
exactly.
You list the ones that are on one hand?
Sorry?
No, I
can't do it right now, but Sydney can probably,
well, no,
or Eduardo can. Yeah, we'll hear about them later. I'm just here to get it warmed up, you know. So the main kinases we'll be talking about today are this this group, which I call the so-called OMPAR family, but that's another story. So,
you mentioned that all this writing are generated by duplication. So, what exactly gets duplicated? It's the histidine kinase domain is more preserved among duplicates, and all these receptor parts are duplicated or just borrowed from somewhere else. You know, I believe saying it's homologous to each other.
All right. Let's just look at this family here, okay? Group 3A. In E. coli and B. subtilis, there's a response regulator gene and a histidine kinase gene. And what gets duplicated is the whole pair of genes. So every one of these kinases has the same in this group, has the same gene arrangement, response regulator histidine kinase. it's also clear that what gets, what's different about each one of them is the signal input domain. How that gets modified, I don't know for sure. But the rest of the things are virtually identical in size and in sequence. Not virtually identical, but it's clear that they all evolve from the same progenitor pair. Okay? So what happens is, when these things evolve, and we'll take a look at that in just a minute, a gene duplication occurs, and then they've got to evolve specificity somehow. And we'll talk about that, hopefully. Yes. Well, because they turn, each one of those pairs turns on a different set of genes. Each has their own genes that they turn on or off, depending on who they are.
And it could be that there's only a small number of signals, and then there's maybe interaction between these different transmembrane proteins. Maybe they can aggregate and pull complex.
Exactly. They possibly. That's still a possibility, which we won't examine. Oh, I'll show you that. Follow along. Maybe I'll show you that. If I don't, I'll forget it. now there's a more complex two-component system called a phosphorelay. Which was first found in sporulation, but basically, as I've already told you, a two-component system works like this. These kinases are dimers. ATP gets hydrolyzed when the signal comes in. This gets phosphorylated. Activation occurs in a phosphorelay. There are more components, such that the kinase structures are the same, the output structures are the same, but there's two domains in the middle. And when we first discovered this phosphorylase in 1989, I said, what's the object of having extra domains in this pathway if the input looks the same and the output looks the same? And the only thing we could come up with was that the more domains you have, the more possibilities you have to control the flow of phosphoryl groups down this pathway. And that's what I'll show you at the end. In fact, that turned out to be true. And the control is even more complex than you might even imagine. But let's first look at the...
The shapes here are suggestive of homology between the domains.
No.
So
the this one are fairly homologous, yes. And it turns out that now after this 10 or 15 years after we discovered this pathway, there turns out that these phosphorylases evolve in various structures. That this one I showed you, the sporulation one, where all the domains are free. In the case of pertussis, they put the histidine kinase in the second domain and the second phosphotransferase on the same protein. Or in the case of yeast, you put the histidine kinase and the first response regulator on the kinase, and then you have the others independent. The point is that no matter what the domain structure is, the pathway is the same. Okay. Now, in general, two-component systems control a lot of different things, like the control of the phosphate level of the cell or nitrogen. They controlled chemotaxis in pathogens. They controlled the production of capsules and hemagglutinations and toxins and surface proteins and autolysins and all kinds of things. Phosphorylase relays, on the other hand, tend to be involved in pathways where there's more information that needs to be assessed in order for you to have the pathway work. Development theory, they're used in enterobiosis and E. coli. Osmotic and developmental regulation in yeast and fungi and Dictyostelium, and ethylene and cytokine responses in plants. So they're, in general, two-component systems don't turn on too many genes. Phosphorelase are in general used for more complex developmental pathways. They probably have more signal inputs, and I'll show you at the end of this how complex that can get. Okay. Now, I'm going to put some structures up here because it leads us to how recognition had to evolve in duplicated pairs, right? So first thing I'm going to show you is a structure of this guy, which we did by X-ray and NMR. This guy, which we did by X-ray, and that's more or less like that four helix bundle. And then I'm going to show you a pair of these two. I'm going to show you an X-ray structure of these two together, which is an actual real X-ray structure. And I may, in fact, show you how this thing binds to its target DNA. This whole system binds to this target. This output binds to this seven base pair sequence. Okay. Yeah.
What happens to this relay if one other component is
missing? Nothing. It stops. It's okay. Dead. It's dead. Nothing happens.
That's really the way to get rid of the phosphorylase.
Sorry. This turns on development. If this pathway is blocked, development doesn't occur ever. And you can't modify, you can't get mutants that overcome the loss of this pathway.
The main question is, what is the role exactly of intermediate steps? Suppose you made the chimera replacing the accepted domain of SPOA by SPOF. Would it still work? Rescued by chimera.
It probably would at some level, yes.
I think the other question was, can you ever get rid of the phosphate from the last one?
From the where?
From the SPO0F, or from any other response.
Well, you can from some others, yes. But in this particular case, we have never found a mutant that it is not phosphorylatable, though that's still active. But you probably can do that, whether it's a single mutation or not.
The question was, can you remove the phosphate and turn the activity of the last thing off? How is it dephosphorylated?
Oh, I'll show you all that. Whose question was that? Can I give this thing my way?
It's your birthday, Jim. You can do it.
I can do it the hell I want, right? All right. So first, I'm going to show you these structures, and that's these response regulators. This is the one SPOF back here. Okay, this guy here. But these structures are virtually. All of the response regulators have essentially the same structure, and what they are is a central beta sheet surrounded by five alpha helices with loops on the top, and aspartic acid residue where the phosphoryl group goes. Okay, This is, and but most of them look essentially like this. And so this what mainly what we're going to talk about it in terms of structure is this top of the molecule, these loops in this alpha helix one in particular. But these loops and this aspartate site. Now, the next guy is this guy here, which is this basic four helix bundle, which is probably the structure of the kinase, although there might be some controversy there, but I don't think so. Basically, when this four helix bundle is composed of two helical hairpins. And when we did this structure several years ago, this is the first time this type of structure had been found. These two helical hairpins dimerize to form this molecule. And the consequence of that is that you've got two histidines on the molecule, one sticking out at us and one sticking back into the wall. So therefore, you've got two active sites on these kinases because the kinases do this. Kinases do the same thing, and so when you look at this now from the top, actually we're going to look down on the molecule. I'm not down. We're going to look at it from the top. I don't want to look down at it because it's mine. When you look down on this molecule from the top, what you see is this four helix bundle. Here's one helical hairpin. Here are the other helical hairpins there. And when you get a co-crystal, which we did, of this thing bound to its response regulator, SPO0F, you're able to define how these two proteins combine to make an active site. Now, that is shown, if you look at it from the side, these two guys aren't really stuck together like ears. They're kind of like ears on a mouse in that the ears, the SPOF is sort of stuck around at the top of the head. There are some people like that, but basically this guy is, and the consequence of that is not trivial. The consequence of that is that the major binding, the strongest bindings is between this helix 1 of SPOF and one of the helices of that helical hairpin. And so what you get is not a 4-helix bundle, but a 6-helix bundle. Okay? So this is the active site. And when you look at, if this is a model of the phosphoryl group that's in it, because when we made the crystal, it didn't have this phosphoryl group there. But if you look at the distances between the histidine and the aspartate that it goes in there, they're perfectly, it's a perfect distance for it being half covalent on either one. So, as I told you, the major interaction, if you take away all the other stuff, the major interaction, here's the histidine and here's the aspartate here, and the phosphoryl group goes there. The major interaction is all hydrophobic, and it's occurring between alpha helix 1 of the response regulator and one of the helices of the helical hairpin. And part of the molecule actually reaches around and touches another helix of the other helical hairpin. Now, well, okay. So this is all leading us up to, I guess, the question of how proteins evolve. There are several ramifications of this in terms of two component systems are important for a virulence, so people think you can make a molecule that will inhibit the interaction of several two component systems and stop bacteria from becoming virulent. I'm an espouser of that as long as they're willing to pay for it. So far, they haven't paid very much. But the main reason that I want to show you this is because we want to look at how how signaling surfaces interact as species evolve. How do you evolve a surface when you duplicate these genes, which have been duplicated many, many times, and now they have to evolve different specificities, not only input signaling. You can say, well, that's easy. I'll just change the input domain so it looks at something else. But the interaction can't be changed because the interaction is precise. If you modify this interaction distance a very tiny amount, it won't work, or you'll get it always stuck over here or always stuck over there. It just doesn't work. So you have to maintain the active site, Jeff, to build the active site such that those two amino acid side chains are precisely the right distance apart in order to effect efficient transfer of that a phosphoryl group from one to the next. So the first thing we looked at was, okay, what happens to the same molecule that we just saw the crystal structure of? What happens to that molecule in different bacteria that can make spores? And so you look at it, and here's the bacillus subtilis we've been looking at. This is anthrax, which is doesn't grow very well except in of victims of bioterrorism, I guess. But and then there's Bacillus taliodurans, which is a bug that grows in alkaline salt lakes. And what you find is that, and we've looked at a whole bunch of others, but basically the take-home lesson is that the residues that are making interaction with the four helix bundle don't change as these systems evolve away from each other. Okay, 20 of 21 residues are identical, whereas the other residues start to evolve away. So that suggests that the actual interaction is maintained, even though the other parts of the molecule evolve away.
Is that also true for the just the four helix bundle without the corresponding response regulator?
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever? Is that also not true? The domains that are responsible for the four helix bundle?
Yes, you classify kinases based on the sequence around the histidine. And so therefore you can look in things like anthrax where you haven't that you don't know which kinase works on SPOF. You can find them by simply look at the helix the residues on the helix. So yes, it's true. They don't appear to they it's a little less clear there, but it's basically the pattern is there. You can see it.
In the other organisms?
Yes, I know that.
They do?
Yeah.
But presumably there are a number of these pairs you're saying of response factor and kinase for helix bundles. If this region which mediates interaction is paired by evolution, then you can make all sorts of pairs if you have several different regulatory systems. They still pair with one another sort of at random.
But they don't, you see.
This is not the entire interaction surface.
What I point out to you on those residues are the surfaces the interaction residues of the same protein in different species,
okay.
Not different proteins in different, the same protein in different species. So this is SPOF from B. subtilis. If you look at anthrax, which is a long ways away from B. subtilis, the same residues are used to bind to the helix, but it's the same protein. And the proteins are interchangeable. We've already done that. Okay?
If I start directly, these are homodimers, right?
Which are?
It forms a homodimer, right?
Well, this is a homodimer, yeah.
Yeah. So, what about the surfaces with which the dimerization takes place?
I haven't really studied them, but they clearly are hydrophobic in all cases. So it's just, I haven't made a study of that.
So you don't know how conserved those are?
No. You'd predict they were somewhat conserved, right? But I haven't really looked at it. I've only been interested in where the other one interacts. I suppose I could look at that. I probably will now. Okay, so what I just showed you simply is the same protein in different species that have evolved a lot of different lifestyles. It turns out that the same protein has the identical interaction surface. Okay? And that's because, as we point out, the active site has to be precisely positioned and precisely made in the same way. Two surfaces have to come together to make an active site. And precise distances for phosphoryl transfer.
So with regard to the thing you started out with, that whole regulation happening last, did these evolve before the species split?
They had to. Once the interaction surface of these two proteins was made, it didn't change a whole hell of a lot. Well, the rest of the molecule can, but it looks like you've got to produce this active site the same way in all of the pairs that eventually evolve. And that raises the question as to how you get specificity, right? Which I think I hope to show you here. Are you staring into space, or are you just?
No, I'm
you're staring at me.
I'm staring at you. I'm waiting for the second shoe to drop.
Oh, you want the shoe to drop? Okay. This is what I just told you, right? Okay. So now we're stuck with this problem that. Bacteria contain a whole bunch of these systems in E. coli 30 to 40, B. subtilis 30 to 40, or something like Nostoc, there's 150 of them. They all have the same virtual structure, and they all rose clearly by gene duplication. Right? So the question is, if these interaction surfaces resist evolutionary change, how do you get specificity? How did amplified evolving two-component system get specificity? Well, this is a lousy slide, but the answer basically comes that there's actually two possibilities, aren't there? Or maybe even more, but there certainly are two. One of which is that the surface evolves at random. So now you've got random changes in the surface that mean that response regulator A will only respond with its own histidine kinase and not with others because there's random changes in the amino acids. The other possibility is that in fact not all of the surface evolves. Some of the surface stays identical and other amino acids change on the surface. So the prediction is there should be conserved amino acids that make up the active site and some variable residues that are involved in specificity determination. And in fact, if the answer is this, the second model is that if you look at These are all the two component systems of the same family in B. subtilis, the so-called Ampar family, which would basically I won't define, but they clearly evolve from the same progenitor pair. And if you look at the interaction residues, that the residues in coral are hypervariable. Those are the residues that are hypervariable. The other residues are more or less conserved in all members of this family. All right. So basically, evolution of these surfaces. We've called them three different types, but anyway, there's conserved catalytic residues. Of course, you have to have the catalytic mechanism there, otherwise it doesn't work. So those are obviously the same. It's like most active sites. They always have a conserved core. The conserved amino acids we call anchor, which are there to make sure that if interaction can occur, that interaction occurs in exactly the same way each time it occurs, so that interaction occurs like this, it doesn't occur like that. And the third type of residue is the hypervariable ones, which by virtue of differences in chemical properties of the side chain, sizes of the side chain, hydrophobicity, charge, etc., prevent pairs from interacting if they're not the right pair.
What does it distinguish those hypervariable sites which are important for recognition from those that are just floating in the wind?
Because you already know which ones are important for recognition from these other studies. We've done a complete. The residues I'm talking about that you see in the structure are identical to the residues we determined from a complete alanine scanning of this response regulator. We changed every amino acid one by one to alanine and asked, what are the important residues for interaction? And basically, when a very satisfying thing was, we did the alanine scanning first. Before we had the structure. And the same residues we found from alanine scanning are making contact in the structure. So we're pretty confident that the residues that you're seeing in the structure and in the alanine scanning are really important for interaction. And in fact, not only did we do that, we did the complete kinetics of this into turning KMs and when Vmaxes. So we know which ones are important for interaction and which ones are important for catalysis. So I'm pretty confident in what I'm saying here.
Can you say something since you said you have the biochemistry of house without house specific compared to that to the you said you have measured KMs or something?
Factors of your K cattle will change tremendously. Factors of 10 or more. Yeah.
How do you call it system modular? If you take the transmembrane domain of one kinase, would you replace the transmembrane domain of another kinase? Do you change the function? Would that?
Well, what you're asking is whether the let me see if I can restate that question, because if that were to happen, then that would state that the however the signal gets recognized by this domain, it induces the same conformational change in the kinase such that it now becomes active. That's what you're asking. And indeed, the few times that it's been done, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. You think, Tom? I don't know if there's how many times it's been done. Huh?
Most times it doesn't
work.
I've been taking an informal survey, and as far as I can tell, I've found far more examples where it hasn't worked.
it's nice when people talk about their own research.
It's not my research, it's a survey. I'm asking people.
Did you have another question, Terry? Yeah.
In different organisms.
Yes.
You see that it's almost completely conserved.
Yes.
If you compare the paralogs from one organism to the different component systems,
right.
One organism, you find conserved sites plus hypervariable sites.
That's right.
And these hypervariable sites are involved in the specificity.
That's right.
So, why didn't these drift between the different species, between the orthologs? Why couldn't the recognition residues change between one orthologue and another orthologue and so on? Why do you think they're so fixed?
Recognition residues or the ones that actually are conserved?
Recognition.
Why are they so conserved in the
cruel balls?
Why are the conserved residues conserved? Because I believe that...
Why are the variable, hypervariable residues conserved among orthologs?
Oh. As we used to say in France, sic comme ça. I don't know. Je ne sais pas. C'est comme ça.
There's no selective pressure for them to change.
Presumably, you don't make a simultaneous double mutation in both components. So
that's right.
But gene duplication, the duplicates can be non-functional for a little while. I mean, it's not lethal for a duplicate to be
non-functional.
More
functional
then.
Not the
half.
Is this color code obtained comparing from the sequence, or do you have some such information about it?
Well, it's mostly there's a couple of them that have been the structure's been done, but most of them haven't. I'll show you something I didn't want to get into, but I will. If you model the proteins based on the structures that you've got, this is all of the E. coli Ampar type response regulators. You can see that all of them superimpose. And this is the subtlest ones. And what you're looking at is this interaction surface at the top, which is where the loops are, plus the aspartate sits in there, in the same place. So. I mean, as long as we're talking about this is a work in progress. It's done by a student at North Carolina State with works with a guy called Cavanna, who's an NMR guy. He and I have worked together a lot on structure. And what this guy has done is he's put together Well, this will just complicate things. But basically, if you look at the top of the molecule, which is here, here's the aspartates here, and a lysine residue that's here. This is the backbone and the model together. He's made a computer program that does what's called a hydrophobic surface gradient of all the members of that family. And it goes from very hydrophobic isoleucine and size about the same to less hydrophobic down there. And this is how the surfaces look if you don't look at the residues that actually interact. Okay, so this is these are a bunch of E. coli things. I don't pay much attention to E. coli, but if you look at Bacillus, it looks a lot better. And basically what you're looking at here are the evolution of the surface per se, and not just using every amino acid as being different, but since all the interactions are hydrophobic, we only looked at hydrophobic, and again, it's a work in progress, mind you. So, but if in fact you say, no, I don't want to look at the entire surface, the entire surface can evolve any way it wants to, as long as it doesn't affect the actual interaction between the two molecules. So I said, well, let's look at this response regulator and these two, because they clearly evolved very recently from each other. They all have different functions, and they're all, almost all of them are lethal, these three, if you knock them out. But so what happens when you look just at the residues involved in interaction? Because now we should see how specificity actually occurs, because they don't cross-interact. And so, this shows that all of this color residue are all the same. This is a weakly conserved, or fairly good, and these red ones are highly variable. And so if you look at that here, what you see is that these are closely related. All of the changes that are occurring on helix 1. That this, the helix that it actually binds to sits in the molecule like this. Now, so take-home lesson is that recognition occurs mainly by amino acid changes in helix 1 of the response regulator. Why did I bring that up? Because I don't want to explain it.
So if you then change the variable regions, can you change the specificity of interaction between the response?
Presumably you can.
Yeah.
I haven't, there's only so much I can do. I'm only just an old guy from the farm. What?
Forcibly duplicate a gene and watch how one of the copies fits?
I'm just a natural historian, is all I am. I could tell you how things happen. I don't like to force things. No, the answer is no, I haven't. No. But did you have something you wanted to ask? Okay. All right. I'm sorry, but my battery's running out. My battery. Why doesn't this move? And why doesn't it move? Here I am.
In your previous slide, you said there was a grating exit. I couldn't see it.
Really, I don't. It's a gradient.
Yeah.
Huh? The gradient is how you define the gradient. But basically, the red ones are.
But when I look at the molecules, I can't see the gradient.
No, of course you can't, because that's not what it's about. You're just looking at the complete evolution of all of the residues on that surface. Not the important ones.
I thought there was a gradient on the surface.
No.
You're looking for a first blend there.
All right, well, here's where I left off before. Whether you believe this or not, I think I do. And basically, the residues that I'm talking about are mainly on helix 1, but also in these loops. And if you look at SPLF, for example, not all of those that I just showed you, the catalytic residues are here. They clearly have to be conserved everywhere. The conserved anchor, what do we call anchor residues that make the interactions that cause the two molecules to stick together are in blue, and the other residues that are hypervariable are there. Now, we just went through all this, right? Now, in the last 20 minutes, if I can I want to look at sporulation. And I'll show you how a phosphor relay integrates information. Okay? And what kind of integration it has to integrate. Now, this phosphor relay that I'm talking about is the basis of a switch between vegetative growth and development. Okay? And so normally you look at two cells and they divide and the septum goes in the middle and they divide. But when you make a spore, you put a septum at one end and you go in and do a developmental scheme. And so the concept basically is what this phosphor relay has to look at. It has to look at a lot of information, metabolic, environmental, and cell cycle information, and somehow decide which way the cell is going to go, either this way or that way. If it decides to go that way toward two cells, then it's stuck. It has to go there. It can't get halfway there, then change its mind. So this is an important switch. And once that occurs, you turn on not only sporulation, but also a lot of stationary phase things. All right. So this is the various stages of it. But what I just showed you was this, where the cell divides with the septum in the middle, to this, where the septum comes at one end. That's shown here. And then once that septum forms, it invaginates around a nucleus, and there's a very complicated series of steps here, but it eventually invaginates around a nucleus and you ultimately get a spore out here, which then can become free. And this is the same stage as whether you're looking at Subtilis or Anthrax or whoever you're looking at. So what we're going to do is look at only at how the phosphor relay integrates information to go either this way or here, and we're only going to look at the amount of information that's required to turn on the genes to put the septum at one end rather than in the middle. Okay? Is that clear? So why do I show you that? Oh, okay. First of all, this is the phosphor relay as we originally described. We all know how it interacts. This is the target of it. And if you knock this gene, this pathway out, you affect the transcription of over 500 genes. Not all of them have to do with sporulation. Some of them have to do with log phase. And that's the reason for that is because of this transition state regulator that I talked about before, which I could show you the structure, but I'm not going to. Okay, now, the first thing that we look at, it turns out not to be just one kinase. Well, there turns out to be five. Yeah, five. And we believe that. Well, in B. subtilis, this is the major kinase. In a shake flask, okay. And this one is the minor one, and these appear to don't appear to work in very well in the media that you can feed the cell, but they clearly are involved, and we can show it by mutation that they can be involved in the active site histidine residues around the histidine are virtually identical in all these, just what you asked me. Okay? So this is, now if you look at something like anthrax, it has five kinases too. Halo, Halodurans has four, but the signaling domains are completely different. No homology. It's clear that these are involved in the sporulation cycle. I can take this one here and this one here and put it into Bacillus acidulus, and it works like crazy. So it clearly, these are the clear homologues. So the take-home lesson from that is twofold. First of all, you can turn on sporulation by different environmental information depending on where you are, in what environment you happen to find yourself. So you get five different kinases, and they presumably can look at different stuff. And as I told you, gene regulation evolved last. These guys, if you are in a different environment, they evolve means to look at the signals that are present in that environment to turn on sporulation. Okay, now let's look at this fossil relay. And in the last few minutes, I'm going to show you the various controls that occur on this phosphorelay. And remember, all this transcription factor does is turn on genes that are involved in placing the septum from one place to the other, either in the middle of the cell or placing it over at one end. So the type of controls that I just talked about, there are five possible kinases, kind A through E. There are several phosphatases. You asked me about these, and several other phosphatases. And I'm going to say there are three phosphatases that can dephosphorylate this molecule. And they all respond to different things. These two are turned on during exponential growth. When the cell really wants to grow, it turns on phosphatases to ensure that no phosphate ever gets to this molecule, or if it gets there, it doesn't stay there. Okay? And they're turned on by different things. This one is actually turned on during stationary phase, and we don't know what it responds to, but it clearly is there to prevent this gene from activating transcription. In addition, there's a family of phosphatases which we called RAP phosphatases, and they don't function on this response regulator. They actually function here. Some of them are turned on by stationary phase things. Some are turned on by growth. So if the cell really wants to grow, it makes a double. But it turns on these guys to make sure no phosphate stays here. It turns on these guys to make sure that no phosphate gets past this point. Okay? And these are all controlled by different input signals. In addition,
How about 0B?
At this point, we haven't found anything that works there, but it doesn't say that you can't. It just hadn't been found. So now you've got a pathway whose sole output is a transcription of about four genes that is controlled by a tremendous amount of signaling that occurs on the pathway. Very specific. These will not work there, and those will not work here. No, not on the other pathway.
As far as the signals, you say, for example, growth is a signal. Do you actually know for any of the kinase or phosphatases, a precise ligand or it may not be a ligand, but...
No, all I know is the phenotypic characteristics of when they're on and...
That's true for all the inputs.
Yeah.
For none of them you have.
No.
Thank you.
So where is the active site for these phosphatases on the phosphatase, or are they stimulating the SPO0A to dephosphorylate itself?
That's a question that has not been answered. I mean, clearly, with the response regulator, it's a mixed anhydride bond, which is very unstable. In it can be hydrolyzed easily, right? And so, if you presumably you could get molecules. What he's saying is you can get molecules that bind to the protein per se, cause some conformational change at a distance that encompasses the active site, open it up to water, and you can dephosphorylate. That's basically what you're saying. Or you can actually have phosphatases that come in and grab a hold of the phosphoryl group itself and pull it out. It's not clear at this point how these kind of phosphatases work. I think that's what you said, didn't it? Yeah. Oh yeah, in the case of the RAP phosphatases, we know that the interaction surface is at the top of the molecule where the phosphoryl group is. We've done that. We've done that using alanine scanning. Yeah, I understand what you're trying to say. Is there a homology? Is there a homology helix there? Is there a helix that mimics posterior B but simply acts as a phosphatase by binding at the same residues? And the answer is, if you look, they're probably all helixes, but I can't see any clear homology that would say yes, it's this helix that must be binding there and causing this to happen. Okay. Now, in addition to these growth and whatever turns on these phosphatases to be transcribed, they're also controlled in another different way in that they're turned on by, in this particular one is called RAPA, it's turned on by a COM-A, a two-component signaling system. And there's another small gene downstream from it, just downstream, that codes for a small peptide that's hydrophobic at one end and hydrophilic on the other. It turns out that this peptide regulates the activity of that phosphatase. And in fact, it's not this whole peptide. It's only those last five amino acids. So what happens is when this phosphatase is turned on, it prevents any phosphate from going on to SPO0A. At the same time, you produce this little peptide, which appears to go outside from a 44 amino acid, it gets processed and comes back in through an oligopeptide permease, and then that inhibits this phosphatase, which allows the phosphate to go on through. So in addition to the controls of just transcription on this, there's a peptide control too. And in fact, in this organism, there are 11 different phosphatases, all that can presumably carry this out, each of which has a different peptide that responds with a different phosphatase. And so there's 11 possible phosphatases that could work on OF, depending on where you are, depending on, you know, whether you're in a haystack or whether you're in a sewer. Oh, actually, bacillus doesn't grow in a sewer. That's E. coli.
How widespread is this phenomenon that phosphatase
action in other two component systems? Well, clearly in chemotaxis there's a phosphatase, a separate phosphatase, and Tom will tell you that every two component system has its own inherent phosphatase. Probably in that case too, wouldn't you say, Tom? The kinases that are actually kinases also can dephosphorylate, not in sporulation, but in E. coli they can do it. And they may be in fact these kinases may be in fact looking at more than one piece of information. They may look at one piece of information to phosphorylate, and one piece of information to dephosphorylate. It's not really clear yet, is it, Tom? Okay. Well, my time's almost up.
Maybe I misunderstood.
Sorry?
Are there phosphatases like this known for any other phospholipid?
No.
That's regulated by something else.
Well, chemotaxis has its own phosphatase, independent.
But is it easy to also be regulated by something else? I mean, not at the gene level, but at the level.
I don't know that it is at this point. Do you? There are so many people working on chemotaxis that I figure that there's no reason for me to understand it. Okay. So basically, that's part of the story, phosphatases. It turns out that it isn't only that. It turns out that there are actual kinase inhibitors, and probably more I could tell you about the kinases too. But there's a kinase inhibitor that we discovered years ago called KIP-I. And KIP-I inhibits kinase A, and it has a partner called KIPA. It's kind of a California thing, but KIP-I and KIPA can make a partnership, so once KIP-I can inhibit, but once KIP-A is made, it takes KIP-I away from kinase A, and they make a pair bond, and this thing can now work. There's also the only part of this scheme I didn't discover. There's a cell cycle. When DNA replication turns on, DNA A turns on a gene, a small gene called SDA, and SDA inhibits kinase A. It comes inhibits. So that then brings DNA replication into this scheme, such that when DNA A is high, replication occurs. It turns on this gene, which then inhibits kinase A. So the system's connected not only to growth in terms of, well, whatever information is over here, but also the cell cycle. Now, this is a structure of. This is the structure that we got of the SPO0A protein binding to its target, and I don't want to go too far into that, but to hell with this. Let's go on to. The final thing, which is, all right, even though, I forget you can't see that screen, but if even with all this information coming in, and the only thing that it wants to do is determine whether there's phosphate on that transcription factor or not, there's anti-kinases and anti-antikinases. There's cell cycle coming in. It turns out that it's not even that simple. There are repressors and anti-repressors working on the few genes that this guy really works on that determine whether, even if you get phosphate here, whether the gene actually becomes activated. So this particular thing's called SPO0A, OJA, but it's actually a partition gene that comes from the chromosome replication. And so when replication is occurring, this repressor sits on the promoters that this guy activates. And it doesn't come off unless replication is complete when these two guys pair up, presumably. There's also a repressor called SINR, which also sits on these promoters, and that's controlled by a thing called SCO-C, which is a MAR-R type regulator, and that these two guys make a pair too, these SINR and SINI. So as long as growth is good, SINR sits on the promoters and prevents this phosphorylated transcription factor from actually activating those genes. And then once this repressor turns on SINI, it pairs up with SINR and takes it off of the promoter and allows this guy to activate transcription. So. I'm sure that's only part of the complication of this whole thing, but it has turned out to be fairly complicated. Thank you very much for listening.
System is you've got to have a whole lot of different conditions satisfied to go to sporulation.
Yes.
It's not an or logic and it's an and logic, right? You can't have RAP A active and you can't have SPO 0E active and so on. All
yes.
these conditions have to be met.
Yes. Absolutely. So what it does is allow a lot of information to be focused on one output, and the reason it's important. If you start fooling with the system and wanting it to, and want it to do things that it doesn't want to do, for example, if you take away any of these controls, you say, well, there are dozens of these controls. It turns out that if you knock out the phosphatases, you see, well, it grows fine, but then, and it sporulates fine, but then you say, all of a sudden it starts to pick up mutants that don't sporulate. And so there's a clear, every piece of this puzzle has its own place that it fits. And if you knock out the negative regulatory aspects of it, the cell responds by accumulating mutants that ignores everything and they don't sporulate at all. So making spores during log phase is a real no-no.
So is it thought that all the problems that you're showing here are dedicated just for the sporulation pathway?
I think so.
The question came up earlier about other phosphor relays and whether there were additional points of control. Not in practice, but these other true phosphor relays. That, and do you know, do you feel that, from what you're saying, I guess you would predict that if they haven't found them yet, people are going to find lots of other points of control instead of them. Other question, that in the other examples, there are not, people have not yet pulled out other phosphatases and...
Well, I mean, I think I can tell you the reason for that, and it's simply the strategy you use to look at the system. If you simply say, I'm going to get mutants that block the system from functioning, then what you do, if I did that with this pathway, I get mutants here, I get mutants there, I get mutants there, and I get mutants up here that are partial because they're more than one kinase. You get a partial block. And we even found this thing, but that's because we had a single mutation that made it hyperactive. Okay? So if you simply use that strategy, let's say I'm going to see what knocks it out, and that's the pathway. All these other things came from a different strategy. We overproduced proteins and asked, do they inhibit this? Are they involved in inhibition of this pathway? Not knocking them out, but overproducing them. And that's how we found most of this other stuff. So if you simply say, well, in yeast this doesn't happen, the question is whether in yeast they've actually done that strategy and look for things this way. And if they haven't, then they probably aren't going to find them, unless they're lucky and find a single mutation that makes one of them hyperactive, like we did here. Well, I think I just said that.
So what fraction of the activators are essential, what fraction of the inhibitors are essential?
Well, you can't think of it in that way. You have to think about a bit what portion of the activators actually have a role.
No, I like to think about it this way. What fraction can be deleted without a complete loss of function of the network?
Without.
When you make a knockout mutation, the stimulatory factor, what fraction of those factors
Well, I mean, that's fine. You can think about, you can knock out all the phosphatases and probably all of these, but what you'll end up with is something that'll grow, but it'll spin off mutants at an exceedingly high rate because it doesn't want to have these genes on during growth. So I guess I can't answer your question.
It's a reciprocal question, but I thought we'd answer. Which ones are absolutely inherited? Which one or ones of the stimulatory factors do you require in order to see its formulation output? Is there any indispensable stimulatory factor?
Well, you need all of these. That pathway in order to have it happen. And if you knock those out, you never see a sporulation.
What about any of the green?
Sorry?
What about any of the factors off of the central pathway of OA or BLM?
No, they're not essential. No.
In the best situation, only of the cells do sporulate, if there is sporulation. They must be so easy to put that. Ideal condition for sporulation, would they all sporulate? 99%, 10%, 10%?
All of the cells in a culture.
Yes, all of the cells in a culture do sporulate.
In the ideal situation, well, at way over half, maybe about 80%.
When you were doing these homology, these comparisons, you were looking at, for example, called the Humpar family, which I was under the impression that is homology based on the DNA binding domain.
That's right.
And yet you were focusing on the receiver domain. And
receiver. Okay.
On the other domain, which is what actually engages the distinct kind.
You're talking about the radio model?
Yeah.
The transmitter and receiver?
It's the other half of the response regulator that actually engages the
That's right.
And so you might guess that there was a lot of mixing and matching between those. So DNA binding domains got mixed relatively easily. So I guess my question is, can you assume receiver domains acceptor domains, whatever they're called, are close if the corresponding DNA binding domains are close? Is that?
Let me just show you something. I mean, I know you guys are probably tired of this by now, but. Now, here's the genealogy of histidine kinases. Is what you're asking?
Well, I've got some response for you.
Yeah, I know, but that it doesn't matter. The way you put them into categories was two ways. The first category was, what's the DNA binding? What DNA binding domain does it have? Is it part of the Ampar family, or is it part of the other family, or is it something else? This is one big family. This is another big family, and these others are something else. Okay. So when we did that, we look. You say, okay, we'll put all of these response regulators in the families based on the DNA binding homology of their DNA binding domain. Okay. Then we said, okay, let's look at the kinases and let's try to put those into categories, irrespective of what the response regulator is. All right. So then we looked at because we knew that the homology had to be around the histidine. We put them into categories based on that. When we did that, the two categories were identical. Okay, so categories that we made of histidine kinases based on the amino acids around their active site were identical to those that had the response. So they all had to evolve from the same progenitor pair. That's the only conclusion you could come to. Well, you could probably, if you're a physicist, you can come to another one, but that's the only one I could come to. Too much for that.
So our last question was saying before, when you get new specificities evolving, is the idea that when you have a duplicated pair, there's no selection on the second pair, and so it can co-evolve to a new specificity?
Well, you know, I guess I don't think that deeply. I mean, you have to change not only you have to change the interaction between the histidine kinase and the response regulator to be specific, clearly. You got to change the signal input domain. And you've got to change the amino acids in the DNA binding domain so it sees something different. So I don't know which comes first, or I really don't understand. Basically,
it seems like you'd have to evolve to change the interactions before you change the inputs, because otherwise you'd be interacting with the wrong thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, is that the idea, that you could sort of lose some of the specific interactions and then make a new pair that would, like, changing a charge pair? Is that how you think about it?
I tell you, I don't think very deeply about that. I mean, I can't. For example, I mean, I could. You know, when you look at a pair of genes where one's a response regulator, and the other's a histidine kinase, you say, well, maybe this whole thing evolved by transposition. And in fact, this group up here have the other order. So it's easy to think about this part of the thing transposing around to new signaling domains. It's more difficult when the multivariable domain is in the middle of the operon.
So they always occur in the same operon?
Essentially, this group of genes always has the same order of genes, response regulator, histidine kinase. This one has completely opposite, histidine kinase, response regulator. That's another reason to think that they all evolve by gene duplication. It's not absolute, but pretty close.
So, do I understand correctly that there's some of these that the function is not known at this point?
There's a lot of the function isn't known.
Could some of those just be duplicates that are drifting around and not really with any function?
Well, it's possible, but basically all of these have been knocked out again in subtle. They've all been done. They've all been microarrayed, and they clearly are all controlling different genes. Some control just a few genes. Other control 30 or 40. I mean, it's.
Controlling something, or are they maybe accompanying something? It's clear that they all have a function.
I understand your question. I just don't know how to answer it. What you're asking is, yes, they do control different genes, but are they looking at different information? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm actually asking if there are some which are hangers-on that are actually not functional, just evolve in the process of evolving into something new.
Redundant.
You mean those that are tenured?
And you won't see anything.
Those that are tenured but can't teach? Is Yeah, there probably are. They're everywhere.
On that note.
Yeah, I think maybe we should make a break and